If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we explore the vibrant and transformative world of textiles and creativity. I'm your host, Mr. X Stitch, and today we are diving into the fascinating topic of craftivism with none other than Betsy Greer, the godmother of the movement herself. Craftivism is all about using craft to create change, whether it's personal, societal, or even global. In this episode, Betsy shares how this idea came to life, how crafting can be a tool for empowerment, and why it's such a powerful form of storytelling. We'll talk about the importance of safety in activism, the layered impact of craftivism, and how even a small creative act can ripple out to inspire meaningful change. Such a great conversation with Betsy. I've known her for years, and I'm so glad to have had her as my first podcast in 2025. It's a wonderful conversation. It's quite a heavy conversation, I'm not going to lie. We get straight into some weighty topics, but, you know, this is serious. This is Needle Exchange. This is what we're all about. So I think you'll enjoy it. I'll be back next week with the second part of our conversation. And if you find somebody else who likes a good thought-provoking chat about the power of craft, feel free to share this episode with them. I'll see you next week. But in the meantime, enjoy the show. In 2024, as the godmother of the term craftivism, how would you define craftivism?
Oh, gosh. I think it is using your textiles and or your textile skills. Well, wait, back up. It's not just textiles. That's just me.
Using your craft-based skills.
Yes, using your craft-based skills for the greater good. Essentially, that is the most basic definition. A lot of people have said a lot of other things, and that's great. I mean, when I started more than 20 years ago now, that was the point. The point was never for me to be the one that was like, this is what you should do. This is how you should do it. That wasn't personally interesting to me. What was interesting was saying, hey, you have the power, you have the skills, you have the talents, and you have your own interests and your own skills and your own history. How can you use craft in a way that helps the greater good? Because that's going to differ depending on who you are, what your story is, what your skills are, what your interests are. It's going to depend on. And so my background is in social science, and I thought that was a lot more interesting to me to say, here's like your craft is empowering. And I'm going to remind you of that. What can you do with it? And then looking back in history and seeing what people have done with it. And then I have a new project about researching the impact of that kind of work. What is the personal impact? What is the societal impact? What is the community impact? What is the long-term impact? Because people will come and they'll be like, I made something about, this is from an actual email, like I made something about climate change and took it to a rally and and climate change didn't change. And like, I think that's very honorable and that's very good that you know, but like if whole governments and whole conferences, you know, like, and countries can't change climate change, one creative act isn't going to change climate change. It's just, however, if you make something and you have conversations and you have, and you talk about it along the way, you change your own actions, you talk to other people and they change their actions, and then it becomes something that can grow over a million stitches and a million conversations. It's not kind of an instantaneous thing, which I think, and anyway, so.
No, that's interesting. So, no. So what you're saying then, so there's a personal layer, there's a community layer, there's a societal layer, and then there's possibly a temporal layer.
Yeah.
I'm glad I found that word. I wasn't sure I was going to do that.
I love that.
Obviously, I've had experience of craftivism to some extent, and I think what you say is true. I think that there's always this, you know, like we can always be the best that we can be or whatever. There's always this aspiration that if you're going to put craft and it's going to have some sort of societal weighting, be it climate, be it politics, be it a local movement and that sort of thing, you hope it's going to affect change. But actually, maybe the perspective that you look at is the thing that upsets the balance, because it may be the only change it needs to make is the change within you.
Right. And then one, my fan is really loud. So sorry.
It's okay. Don't worry.
Okay. Right. I just wanted to, sorry. Hopefully you can edit that part out. But I just, right. because I recorded interviews before and they were like, there's this in the background and we can't use it. And I was like, oh no, we're talking about really cool stuff. So, okay. Great. It's all right. So, but yeah, I think that the important piece, like there's been some research about certain projects and the impact was mostly, you know, it was the product was for somebody, but the impact was mostly within the person that made it. Mm. So I think sometimes that is a mismatch, right? Like if you're making something, you need to, like for donation, you need to also think about, is it something that is needed? Is it something that is, you know, because there are cases where making a quilt will be really important and impactful, but there are other cases where giving money is going to be more impactful because they're, you know, like I live in Western North Carolina where they had those big floods. So it's not 3 hours away. Like when your house is all gone and everything in your business is all gone, like there are things that you need first.
Yeah.
Other than something.
The quilt would be nice, but.
Right. And I think that when you make things, I think there's also like, how is it going to be used? What is the impact? What, and I've had that question be asked a lot of times. So I'm really interested in looking at the impact of how things change, because there is such a personal change. And that also comes from my own personal experience of working with textiles and the voice that it has given me. And I think a lot of that is because you're making something and you're making a lot of choices, right? You're making, what is it going to look like? What do I want to make? What stitches am I going to use for textile based things? Like what? And so you're making all these choices. And I think the transformational piece comes from if you've been in a situation or your life is such that you haven't made a lot of choices on your own or haven't been able to make choices or haven't felt safe to make choices, that making all these choices and craft projects is something that isn't talked about as a lot as something that is transformational. So I guess because for me, craftivism started and I started talking about it and then started sharing people's voices and their stories. And then about 7 years ago, realized that I guess a trigger warning here. I had been assaulted in my early 20s and had repressed it.
Right.
So there is this discovery of people using tapestries to show that their relatives had disappeared in Chile or in Argentina, and like, you know, these different ways, and that prisoners of war had unpicked or cut up socks to stitch with, mm-hmm. and like all these mm-hmm. ways that people had used their voice in situations with craft was so important to me, and I didn't know why. And then I like remembered, and then was like, oh, this is why it was so important, and why making and having choice in the process was so important, because I felt like there were certain choices that were taken away from me. And so every time I chose to make a scarf in a certain color or to stitch anything, that was just a little choice that I was making and showing up. Well, you can hear my cat now.
Even the cat is choosing.
Yes, she
to
is
have
choosing.
A conversation with yes. us right now.
She has some kitty dementia when she drinks water. And is like, where am I? Yeah. So I don't know if that gets too in the weeds about craft, but I think that making all these choices over and over again can shore up who we are.
Yeah, I can see it. Because the thing is if you follow a campaign that is already prescribed, mm-hmm. then you're already letting go of some of the choices, aren't
right.
you? You're expressing within certain predetermined confines. The placard is a certain size, the terminology you're using. And I guess then it's somewhat bespoke, isn't it? You're aligning to a cause,
right.
but that's not necessarily the true expression of how you may want to be active within that. I think that's yeah. what you're saying, right?
Yeah,
is that, you know, but if you make a protest banner the way you want to make it, regardless of if it makes any sense whatsoever, that's your expression of the issue bespoke
right.
to you.
And you're making a million different tiny choices. And I think that if you're doing a project that somebody has already started, that can be a great entry point. I think mm-hmm. a lot of times people are like, how do I join? How do I do this? Especially in like, I would say 10, 15 years ago, a lot of people would email mm-hmm. me and be like, how do I find my own group? And I'd be like, start your own group. Mm-hmm. And, but they'd be like, I don't know how. And you can join. People are doing fantastic work and, like in group projects. And I've had projects where people have sent in stuff and it's been great. But I think, and making your own stuff and your own work. I mean, think about textiles, right? Like I'm sitting like right behind me is this this crewel work that was done from a kit. Like it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's fantastic, you know, but sometimes you may not want choice, right? You may just want to sit mm-hmm. down and but
yeah.
when it comes to activism or sharing your voice or then making all those choices can be important along the way.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. So when you said at the start that craftivism is for the greater good,
mm-hmm.
the greater good doesn't necessarily mean it has to have an impact on a lot of people. It could just be that you've made something that changes your outlook, and as a consequence, your outlook reflects onto other people.
Yeah, because loud cat again. So, but I, yeah, because think about it. If we change how we show up in the world, if we better understand who we are, if we better understand, why we're here, right? Then the way that we just are in the world affects other people. And I think that there's often a huge wish for massive change right now. And I think that's great. I think those efforts are fantastic. And I think that there should be more of them. But I also think that there is room to show up and to create change in all sorts of ways. And if we create change in ourselves, then we can show up in bigger and better ways with others.
Yeah. Hmm. There's a book I read / listened to, which I don't know if I've mentioned on here before, but I've told quite a lot of people about it. It's by a guy called Oliver Berkman, and it's called Meditation for Mortals. Now, Oliver Berkman used to write a column for The Guardian, and he wrote a book previously called 4,000 Weeks, which says, you know, we're around for 4,000 weeks. Do you know of it? Yeah,
I do.
And so Meditation for Mortals is like the follow-on for that. And a lot of his thesis is just saying, we could be the best that we could be. We could do all the things. We could meditate. We could do all the practices. We could clean living. We can time manage ourselves and all of those sorts of things. But we are finite, and we are never going to do all the things that we could do. And the things that we do, we're never going to do them as brilliantly as we could do. And accepting that fact is a great release. He says it's a bit like if you're walking in the rain and you're wet, and at a certain point you just go, sod it, I'm wet. And you just accept it that you're just going to be wet for a while. And that release of like trying to be dry, trying to fight against the system, that freedom is really significant. And I think that is in tune with what you're saying. It's something that really appeals to me now because like I'm nearly 50. Mm-hmm. I realize I'm only going to change the world across it. I'm just going to change the world across it. No, but you know, you can't change anything other than what you are doing in your realm. Because that's literally the only control that you've got. You don't have control over your partners, your children, the streets around you, but you can control yourself. And therefore, if you, as we just said, if you can be a little bit more at peace with yourself and a little bit happy with yourself because you're not trying to win unwinnable battles, then maybe that just casts a different glow on the people around you. And maybe that's all the activism you need.
Yeah, I think it's a personal choice. I think that... that when it comes to activism in general, not everybody is safe to show up in the same ways. It depends on who they are, what is happening in the country, what is happening. And so I think that everyone needs to find a way that is safe for them. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have, you know, projects like the Protest Banner Lending Library in the US that created protest banners that you could make in a workshop or you could rent out, because not everyone felt safe to be showing, you know, up in a public protest because, you know, sharing certain thoughts or certain whatever. And so everybody has to find a way that works for them. And which I think is really beautiful because there's so many different ways. Like Sarah Corbett has been talking to power holders, right? Like I think that's a really beautiful way of doing that. For me, it's come through from more of a mental health angle and of talking a lot about like doing affirmations, doing things about joy. I'm currently doing a project that's about mantras and mantras for making. And then I'm thinking about, I've done some workshops, some embroidery workshops based with Zine about making your mantra and figuring out like, how do you find what is important to you about making? And, and then I'm thinking about turning that into some group workshops so that people work together on like creating a mantra together for joy and then making that together and then displaying it somewhere in like a temporary display, having a nice photo of it. That is my current kind of idea of working together with people on aspects like creativity or hope or joy or making as a way to show up in the world. And I've done a lot of little pieces around that. But I think the conversations that you have around those things are really beautiful. And so, I don't know. It sometimes feels like, oh, is this too navel-gazing? You know, where I'm like, I'm going to sit and think about all the things in my life about stitching. But I think a lot of this also comes as a direct reaction to how stitching has been seen over time. Mm-hmm. As something that is, oh, you just have, you know, people that learn to stitch and they have to do these samplers and they have to be perfect, and that teaches them how to, you know, do all sorts of skills so that to prepare them for a certain kind of life over history. But I think that there is so much power in creating something through textiles. And I think that there is so much power historically through that as well, that I feel like it, all the, you know, my ancestors and people before me that stitched and, you know, created beautiful tablecloths and napkins and whatever and dresses and like all that runs through me and then runs into the future. That was really wide ranging. So hopefully that didn't sound too bananas.
It's not bad for the first 15 minutes of a conversation either. Right? Next, astrophysics and the meaning of life.
I know,
no,
sorry.
Right. So, so when I was talking to Andrew Crummy in the previous Needle Exchange, and he's been involved in the world of like the historical tapestry because he did the Great Tapestry of Scotland. He's also been involved in the Scottish diaspora tapestry, which is obviously the history of Scotland around the world.
Right.
And then now he's also involved. He's done lots of them, but he's also involved in the history of Europe tapestry because clearly the history of Scotland just not big enough.
Awesome.
But I love it. I love the fact. But one of the things that we talked about, now I know the Bayeux Tapestry wasn't created in 1066. It was very much a historical reference.
Right.
But I think it's interesting that tapestries like that, the public conception of them is that it's a bit of history. Whereas actually the Great Tapestry of Scotland is a moment of now that will then become a bit of history because textiles has got more, it just lasts longer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, the things that you're saying, the personal mantras, the stuff that Sarah's doing strategically, all of these things offer an opportunity for documenting what's going on as much as anything, don't they? They're statements of a person's position at this space and time right now. And maybe that serves a function because it may be that 100 years down the road, someone will pick that up and look at it and it will give them a different perspective on what's going on right now.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of things. Like, I think that you have Diana Waymar's Tiny Pricks Project, right? Which documents a lot of things. Initially, it started out with documenting things that Donald Trump had said. So as a way of documentation of what was all the things that were that were being said. Just, you know, yes. And so there is a documentation piece of, this is what we cared about. This is important. And maybe that is on a, could be on a micro level or on a macro level as well. And, you know, that is important in all its forms. I'm looking right now. I have my grandmother's first, she did a sampler in 1935, she was 10. And it's a little wonky. She hates it. She hates that I have it in a frame.
She hates that you love it to bits.
I do. And, but all these things are just, documents of who we were and how we are and how we've progressed over time. And I think when it comes to different artists or different creative processes, like you get to see like these, this is what was important to me at this point. This was what important to me at that point. And sometimes that's affected by things like sales. You know what I mean? Like if someone, you know, kind of like likes one piece, you may try to replicate that to capitalize, I guess, if you're selling on that motif. But I think that, I don't know, I think creative stuff is so important as, like you said, a document of what's important to us as humans. And
so I'm just going to say Needle Exchange episodes 55 and 56, Diana Waymar there, for anybody going and listening back.
Nice.
We had her on. But I think, no, I think you're right. The thing is like when we were talking about the work that she was doing, each of the people who make a thing in that context, whatever they choose to focus on, they're saying, this is my like truth to power. This is me saying, this is what's going on right now. And cumulative, like with her project, it was cumulative. Mm-hmm. The more certain themes came up, the more you could tell it was like a sort of barometer of that period of time. So actually, if you're able to look at the chronology of the first phase of the Tiny Pricks Project, because God damn it, there's going to be another phase. Then you can sort of see, you know, it does provide, it's like an infographic. Mm-hmm. It kind of provides that information. And I think the interesting thing is whether you choose to do, like at the Knitting and Stitching show recently, they're the Subversive Stitcher, and she's got all these really retro tea towels with statements stitched on the front of them, and they're absolutely fantastic. And I definitely want to get in touch with her about that.
She's great.
Because it works. Yeah. And that's another, it's another version of kind of like saying this is what's relevant right now. But even if it is like your grandma's thing is a memento that helps you understand her, albeit when she was 10. But for instance, if she did something that was when she was 50, or like my mum crochets blankets and we've got some of her blankets, and I like to think my grandchildren will have those blankets and they'll go, this was a piece of what our great grandma was like. It's just a statement of who that person is. It's an object. It's like an artifact, isn't it? And maybe the greater good, referring back again, is the resonance that it leaves with us about those people. Because regardless of the way the world turns and the pictures that are painted about societies in general, or looking back on history and all that kind of thing, if we have these tangible moments, as weird as they are, they tell us a thing. So I live in Crewe, industrial town. We were talking about artifacts, and there was a guy I know, and his granddad worked in the railway works making trains, and he's got this manual that his granddad had from when steam trains turned into electric trains, and his granddad had got this book that he had to learn because he was a train builder. Mm-hmm. And he's got all these like notifications and you know, he's written in the annotations in the side and all that sort of thing, and that's a real artifact because it explains about a man trying to adapt to society and adapt to the changes taking place. And so maybe a lot of these things, even if you just do one thing, and even if it just says, please don't leave dog poo on the street outside my house, or whatever it is, that's a moment, isn't it? That's the thing. That's like that artifact.
Yeah, and it's also, textiles also document the passing of time, which people have done, you know, like dealing with grief or illness or emotions, or you have people like the Tempestry Project that are doing historical and current you know, temperature ranges, right? Of like, you know, different this is what it was like in this national park. And this year, these were the temperatures, and you can see it in a visual way. And so you have this great combination of passage of time and a visual reference. And then now with social media, you also have a photo that exists beyond that as well. And there's so many ways to take time and I think and to show what's going on in your life. And I think that people sometimes are like, but I'm not creative, or I don't know what to do. And then I think that there's so many spaces to be creative and to do new things, but you have to sit down and think about what's important and play around first. And because you don't know what's going to be a documentation in 100 years time, right? Like the train. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know. But I think that if you want to be creative, it's important to share your thoughts and feelings and ideas.
So I'm going to just challenge you for a second, just because you would think sometimes if we just said, what is craftivism, then you would come out and you would say it is making statements. It's the things people expect. It's like the tropes. It's like making statements, trying to affect change and all those sorts of things. And what you said is yes, but there's kind of a big but in there. And I understand the but I wonder whether you can elaborate on it, because it's you're not being pessimistic. I feel like you're being pragmatic. You're trying to mitigate people's hopes. But I just want to dig into that a bit more.
Of course. You mean the but, like it won't change things immediately? Which but are we talking about?
Sort of. Because I think the thing is I think like you don't want people to feel the futility. You know, you get clicktivism and all of that sort of stuff, and it seems futile. And we're saying people want to make things, to make a statement, to represent their truth in a given situation. But that but, I think, can come across as sounding like depressive or something. Sure. And I know that's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I want to pick at it a bit more.
Of course. I think that there are these huge intractable issues, right? Like for a number of years, I worked at a company that worked with apparel factories, right? And so they were audited, and then I worked with the big companies to help them remediate some of their issues and edited reports and stuff like that. But you see, like, all of the 8 million issues that apparel factories have and why things cannot be changed immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But if you can get companies to say, to realize that, for example, there was a big issue for about locking doors on the inside.
Right.
And if you can get companies to change things, like, okay, we're going to leave. Our workers can leave, right? Like, that's a big, tiny victory. Mm-hmm. It's big and tiny. I mean, or at the same time, right? Yeah. Because there's so many other things. There's, in the report, the 20-page report, there were 12 other things that they needed to fix. But this is what we can fix right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're usually, and I mention that because they're with problems like climate change or with things like that, there's so many things to fix. So what can you fix? Maybe you can talk about it on a global level. Maybe you can start, maybe you can look at a local creek in your area. How can we clean up that? Where can we fix that? How can we change our city laws? How can we do this? Mm-hmm. So I think that it depends on what level you're starting in and what you expect. Because again, I think also, like, when it comes to climate change, if you, you're the thought of, I'm going to change this with this banner, and then realizing also that whole countries and governments haven't been able to change this. And it's been, a huge issue. But maybe that is not something that you're going to immediately change, but you're going to have conversations while you make the banner. People are going to ask you about the banner. And also, if you have an educational piece about it, which a lot of projects have educational pieces, which I didn't really see the light. And Sarah Corbett actually was like, but what does it do? And I was like, when she asked that question, I'm like, but there, the educational piece of, like, how can I help? Mm-hmm. So maybe you have a banner and then you have something that's like, that you hand out, or a QR code that sends you to a landing page or something that's like, these are steps that I can take. Mm-hmm. And that is also important, because I think sometimes we get stuck in the giant things, mm-hmm. like a giant election that is, pretty disappointing, for example. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, but what else, what can I do? Mm-hmm. I can create community. I can volunteer more. I can do, like, I can share work about hope. I can do, what are things that I can do that are in my control? Or at least, if not directly in my control, that I can affect in a smaller way. I think it's just often taking a step back. Does that help?
Yeah, I think so. And the thing is, it's not a wrong answer, but I think there's something there. Like you say, it's like, I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were saying, every time the Prime Minister of the UK meets up with the Premier of China, everyone says, will you speak to them about human rights? And they do. And they've been doing it for 30 years and China hasn't changed its tune on human rights in all that time. Like, it's not like it's futile, but I think to what you're saying is, like, it would be better if you're frustrated about climate change. It would be better to, like, do a cross stitch that has 35 F-bombs in different colours on it to get that out of your system.
Yeah.
And then think, maybe I can just tend to a green space around the corner and do some, signs that reflect that or something. Right. And just try and regain a perspective that you can affect. Because if everybody changed their minds in the right direction, we could make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. But it seems like that's a really big ask.
And it's also easy to get really down when really big, horrible things happen. And I think if you have something with 1 million F-bombs, that's fantastic. You are getting it out of your system. You feel that way. Mm. And then also you can share that. And also, like, this is what I made because I was really frustrated. And here are, a couple things that I'm going to do as well. So they work in tandem together.
Yeah.
But I think it's also personal preference on what you feel. I think that I think questions around impact, questions around change, are always, people always want to know, like, how can I, but I think sometimes you have, like I said, take a step back and look at what, you know, are you, you know, I want to change, again, we'll use climate change. And then, but are you doing that on a local level? Or are you just saying, why isn't the world climate change any better, or my country's? And then getting really angry at that. There are times definitely when I want to throw my phone across the room when I read the news. Frequently, you know, but at the same time, what am I doing right here, right? Or in my house?
Yes.
Or, you know, am I, you know, making sure that I'm using products that don't, you know, make things worse? And I think that that is a way to help combat the despair sometimes. It's really big things. And creativity, of course, can come into play with that as well, with different types of projects. But I think also you have to kind of balance that, I think, a bit. Because if you fight against huge issues, I think how much burnout is huge around people that are activists or whatever, I think, because like you said, like things, big things sometimes take a long time to change, you know, in 100 years, we may be like, look, you know, when the prime minister talked to the guy in China on the 36th, you know, year, things changed, but how do you get through those 36 years in a way that sustains you?
Yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? And it's, and to that, when I was saying about meditation for mortals, you know, it's like, if you feel that there's a futility there, the, probably the best thing you can do is go, what feels, what's the opposite of futile? What is there something that has a purpose and I can affect and just focus on that, rather than the sunk cost bias of continuing down a path that's futile because you've already been down that path for quite a long time?
Yeah.
Like it takes bravery to go, oh, I'm just wasting my time, and I can go and find something else to channel my energy in. But you need to channel your energy into something that, you know, the joy of making being then mitigated by the futility of the output takes away the joy of making, doesn't it? Yes. So you think, well, actually, one of my favorite projects that you did was You Are So Very Beautiful. And I think that encapsulates, you know, that's the ideal kind of project to talk about at this point in our conversation.
Sure.
Can you just go over what that was about?
Yeah, so I was doing this thing called the 5-Minute Journal, which asks you, like, three things, good things that happened today, or whatever, in the morning and the evening. There are different questions, right? And in the morning, there was a question that was like, you had to say an affirmation about yourself. And I hated it. I hated it. It was like stupid. I would, you know, I would do it on my morning commute when I lived in Washington, D.C. And I would just find myself like looking out the window and being like, I don't know. Or, and I would write like, I am kind or something, you know, fairly banal.
I smell great.
Right. You know, I am a nice person. And it always felt hard, like really hard. And I was like, huh, what if I started stitching affirmations, and will they kind of sink in, right? Will they sink into to me? Well, and what feels true and what doesn't? And and then I think a lot of times when we're like, I'm so bad at coming up with affirmations or whatever it is, I can't cook, I'm not creative, whatever it is, or to other things about ourselves personally that we think, or negative self-talk, whatever, we're never alone, ever. So on that. So I was like, well, what if I share them? And then what if I leave them out in public? And we did that knitting and stitching show workshop, which you were so kind to let me be at your booth. And it was fantastic. So then I had workshops about people, having people make affirmations. And it was a project that was repeated all over the world and by different people. And it was just something that grew from me making these little things that, these little pieces, and that were palm sized. And then we showed them at the Fuller Craft Museum in an exhibit, curated by Faith Levine, and were a bunch of, you know, we collected a bunch of them and had them on display. So it, and then when I was at that show, because people are like, affirmations, oh, they're stupid. People have a lot of big thoughts about affirmations. And and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the piece, like the collection, after it had been installed. And then this woman was there and she was like, the energy here is so good, standing in front of these pieces. And I was like, did someone tell you to come over and stand here? So I think that the cool thing about affirmations is that you're going to have people that say, this is stupid, I hate this. And oftentimes that it can be, it isn't always, a sign that, you know, you are enough or you are beautiful, whatever it is, is something that doesn't ring true to you. Mm-hmm. And is something that is maybe that's a sign pointing to something to work on. Or maybe it's something that feels great and you need to be reminded of. So I think that it was a small project, right, that went in a lot of different ways. There was a professor in Canada that, a jewelry professor, that made rings with affirmations. I have one on right now. It says, you were lovely. She sent me one. And left them out for people to find. So I think you can take other people's projects and expand on them. And so I love having kind of small things and sharing them, and you never know where they're going to go or who's going to see them.
Yeah. I often find, like, I get this thing, I call it like my nostrils flare. And who was I talking to? I was talking to someone else once who said that their teeth itch. When you get certain things, it just don't quite sit right for me, my nostrils flare. But what I'm starting to understand is, if my nostrils flare about a thing, that's a hurdle that I need to get over. It's almost like a sign that I'm going to have to, like, I think my nostrils nearly folded in on themselves when my wife first said we should try like ballroom dancing 10 years ago or whatever, because it was dreadful and I hated it. And upon reflection, I think that's fantastic because I grew in a direction I wasn't expecting. I mean, can't dance for toffee now. But I feel like when you run up against those things where you're like, oh, this is making me cringe, it's nothing to do with the thing. Is to do with you, and maybe you owe it to yourself to get over it, get through it somehow.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, again, that's a personal choice, right? And then if some things are super triggery, then maybe you need to get like professional help, which is why I mentioned that too.
Yeah.
But I found them really fascinating, and how people had these really polarized reactions to them. And then it was, so whenever anyone like made fun of the project, which happened occasionally, then I was like, well, okay, that's on you, right?
Yeah. You need my other project. You Are So Very Cynical.
Right. It's a different project. And I think that you know, there was a period in like the early 2000s where everything was ironic and everything. And like, on it. Yeah. And that was, although that skit is hilarious, but like, you know, but like everything was ironic and people weren't vulnerable, and I hated the period of time. Right. So I love that there is an open space now to be vulnerable and authentic and talk about things through craft. And then when you look back through history, it's always been there. We just haven't always, you know, or I guess I said I haven't always realized that. So it's fun to play around with.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.